everybody. It's really good to be here and see all of your faces. I'm glad we have a packed house. And I'm going to introduce myself and move to amend more in just a minute, but I like to practice what I preach, and what I preach is democracy, and one of the lost arts of democracy is listening to each other. I think it's very important to practice democracy with each other, because democracy is not an institution, it's a verb, and we do it every day, or we should do it every day. And I think talking to each other helps us to break out of the isolation that the corporate media and corporate influence of our lives puts us in, and helps us to feel like we're understood and that it's okay to be outraged and that we can be powerful together. So I believe that, well, I'll ask you all, who here is outraged by corporate control of their lives? Okay, then you're all in the right room, because I'm outraged too. And I believe that outrage is the appropriate response to hundreds of years of abuse, manipulation, and exploitation. Outrage is a good response to that. I believe that outrage, when it sits in you and you don't move, turns to poison. So I'm here to channel outrage into action, because I believe that action is the antidote to outrage at your government. So that's what we're here to do today. We're going to talk about history, but the goal is action. And I'm going to make myself play my own game, because that's democracy too, right? And I'm going to tell you why I'm here. Libby told you a little bit about what I do, but why do I do it? And my story, or one of my stories, is that I come from Salt Lake City. Has anybody here been to Salt Lake City? Okay. Wow, all the Washingtonians have been to Salt Lake City a lot. So you can probably answer this question. In the winter, if you went there in the winter, what color is the sky? What color is the air? Okay, that's already a frightening question. What color is the air? Someone said brown? Okay, it is brown. It can be lots of different colors. I call it a radioactive rainbow soup. And we live in that. And on any given day, I live in a city with the most air pollution in the world. And some days, you can really tell that that's true. It was so bad that when I was growing up, I wasn't allowed to go out for recess, because the air was too toxic to breathe. People in my community die years earlier because of breathing in that toxic air, and many, many children and elderly people have asthma. And I remember when I was little, my teacher asked us to draw pictures of the future, and I guess I was feeling in a particularly dystopic mood that day, because I used all my black and brown crayons to draw the sky, and then I drew a picture of myself with a gas mask on. And she probably thought I was a disturbed child, until 20 years later, I was on my way to school, and I looked next to my car at the light, and I saw a woman on her bike with a gas mask so that she could breathe. So I felt vindicated. I wanted to write my teacher, but I don't know where she is. and I was so angry about that. I thought, we have to wear masks because the air that we live in is so toxic. Why? Why is that? And as I started researching, I found out that one of the reasons is that the world's largest open-pit copper mine is in my backyard. Rio Tinto Kennecott, anybody heard of it? And they make $14 billion a year profiting off of mines that kill people all around the world. Kill workers, and also kill people who breathe the air around those mines, kill animals. And they're making lots of money at their London headquarters, and we're breathing lots of dirty air where I live. And so I decided to take action on air quality and a lot of other issues that mattered to me, and I did everything that my high school civics teacher told me to do. So thanks to high school teachers. And I organized, and I educated, and I had myself be educated by other people, and we went to meet with officials, and we went to meetings, and we would go to regulatory meetings about the expansion of this mine, and we would pack the room, 400 people in the room, you know, moms saying no, babies wearing onesies that said, don't kill me, you know, we weren't messing around with our messaging, and all these citizens arrayed in protest against this mine. And every single time, we lost. Every single time, they expanded the mine. And after that happened, for years and years, I realized that the whole thing was a foregone conclusion. Corporations were more important than people. They were going to win, and we were going to watch. And our presence there basically put a veneer of democracy on a sham. And we were there to legitimize the seizure of our rights right in front of our faces. So I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. Or actually what I said is, I am still going to do this, work on immediate issues that are important to me, but I'm going to also work on root causes of the problem, because if we don't solve the root cause of corporate power, we don't have a prayer in solving the immediate things that we need to solve to live basic, healthy, and productive and happy lives. And so I got involved with a group called Democracy Unlimited, and in 2010, after the Citizens United decision, we formed Move to Amend. And that's my way of working on structural change while also working on immediate, necessary, urgent change. And I think all those things have to happen and feed into each other for us to win justice and win equality. So what is Move to Amend? Who here already knows what Move to Amend is? Okay, so a lot of folks don't. I'm going to tell you what it is, and we're going to spend the rest of the night figuring out why it is. Why does it exist? Why do we have the strategies we have? What's this all about? So Move to Amend is a national, grassroots, multiracial, different geography, different income coalition of almost 300,000 people and almost 200 affiliates who are saying no to the corporate takeover of our lives and our government, and who are organizing to amend the Constitution of the United States to say that corporations are not human beings and that money is not speech. So I was speaking to a class of elementary kids about corporate power a while back, and I said, I'm trying to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people. And a little kid said, duh. And so I always think about that kid whenever I speak, because it is duh. Sometimes I'm almost insulted that I have to be working on this issue because it's so crazy. It's obvious. When people don't know that it's already an issue, when you say the sentence to them, they're like, wait, what are you I don't understand what you're working on. And so, but what we're really after is starting a conversation about corporate power in our lives and about democracy. So Move to Amend's first goal is amending the Constitution. And people come up to me on the street sometimes, and they you know, approach me like they're going to give me a tip, and they do, and they say, hey, did you know that amending the Constitution is really hard? And I say, oh, it is? You should totally help then. I feel really overwhelmed. You should get involved. But the fact is that at Move to Amend, we know that amending the Constitution is a huge deal. And we take our playbook from past movements for social justice, the abolitionists, the women's suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, farm workers movements, all the movements that make our country something that I can be proud to talk about in a room full of people. And but we also know that amendments don't just happen overnight, and so our second goal is actually much bigger than an amendment, and it's necessary for an amendment to happen, and that's that we want to build a democracy movement, a movement of people who are affected by corporate power, a movement that cuts across issues. Whatever you care about is affected by corporate power and would be benefited by more democracy, so a movement that cuts across issues, and also a movement that recognizes explicitly the way that corporations have created and perpetrated and exacerbated things like racism, classism, and sexism to keep us apart and keep us from forming movements that actually threaten their power and that have disproportionately harmed so many people and that have harmed all of us, but harmed some of us a little bit less so that we don't see our solidarity and alliance with other people. So we're a movement that wants to build across issues and across lines that normally divide us to build power that is so strong that a corporate-occupied Congress and a corporate-occupied country can no longer ignore us, that they have to concede to our demands. So we're about grassroots, movement building, structural change, and broad, broad-based vision of the world that we actually want to live in. So does that sound good to you folks? Okay. Awesome. So tonight we're going to dig into some history. And that might be strange because you might say, well, I graduated from high school 20 years ago, 50 years ago. Why do I need a history lesson? I think that we need history lessons because history is the story of power and how power operates. Who decides, who loses, and whose story gets told. And I think if we know the stories that people in power don't want us to know, we'll be better equipped to act in the present in the name of justice and equality. So this is a story tonight about how corporations got their power and how people have always formed social movements to fight the power of the moneyed and the wealthy and the unjust to build justice for themselves and for their brothers and sisters across the world. So we're going to talk about that, and I'm going to do a long history. We're talking 500 years in a very short amount of time. And then we're going to actually finish that history by teaching each other the history, because I don't think that I know everything. Some people I know might think that I do, but I don't. And I think that you know a lot. So we're going to spend part of the night teaching each other, why is Move to Amend's goal amending the Constitution? Why do we need to do that? And why do we need to build a democracy movement? What are movements all about? And why does the movement have to actually fight and heal the wounds of racism and classism and sexism in order to win and in order to be just? And we're going to dig into why we need to do that together by creating people's timelines. Hopefully a lot of you will be participating in that by the end of the evening. But first I'm going to give you some background, and we're going to race through history really fast. So let's take this metaphor that a corporation is a person, this tortured, distorted metaphor. Let's take it seriously for a second, and let's start with that and say, if a corporation is a person, then corporations have a birthday, right? People have birthdays. So can somebody in the audience tell me when the modern corporate form was born? I'm not asking right now when corporations got personhood, because we'll talk about that. But right now I'm asking when the modern corporate form was born. Yeah. Yes, right around then. So the modern corporate form came into existence around the 1500s, that century. And something was going on in the 1500s around the world. Rich men in Europe were sending out ships to foreign lands in an age that historians often euphemistically call the age of what? Exploration or discovery, right? So I believe that history happens in the euphemisms and the fancy phrases. So tonight's going to be breaking apart euphemisms and fancy phrases. The age of exploration is a mega euphemism. What was actually happening at that time? What was it actually the age of? Age of what? Exploitation? Slavery. Conquest? Slavery? Empire. Okay. We've made a good short list of depressing words. And they're all correct. So it was the age of mass imperialism, colonization, exploitation, and as a result, the age of genocide and slavery. So the corporate form actually grew up at the same time as the age of colonization. Is that an accident? What is it about the corporate form that makes it the perfect vehicle for mass colonization? Or, in other words, to do something to people en masse that you would have a really hard time justifying doing face-to-face. Okay, removes liability. And I see another hand back there. Okay, so exploitation of labor and limitation of liability. Those are two really good answers. The corporate form is a form that actually institutionalizes irresponsibility and incentivizes violence and keeps the individual who perpetuates it unaccountable and maybe even unaware of what they're doing. And so it's a perfect vehicle for mass violence, right? And how did this happen? What is it about the corporation that makes it that perfect form? And to answer that, we're going to have to talk about some of those men in Europe who wanted to become incorporated so that they could go out and colonize and exploit. And these men were, as they often are, just a few small but very powerful white European men. And they said, hey, I hear there's a new world out there, new to us at least. And we want to go and make a ton of money, but we've heard one thing, which is that people don't really like being exploited. It's just this thing. And so it's pretty risky to go and conquer whole swaths of the globe. So what we want is to make as much money as possible without a lot of risk. How can we do that? And they sat and they scratched their heads and they thought, who can help us? And then they thought, ah, ding, ding, ding. That guy who always helps us when we have a problem, our friend, our pal, the king. We're going to go to the king and see if he can help us out. So they trotted over to the palace. And the king's sitting there boo-hooing because he's been fighting lavish wars and throwing lavish parties, and his treasury's not looking as hot as it used to. And so he's saying, oh man, how can I get more rich? And the economic elites knock at his door. They come in. They have a meeting. Whenever in history you hear about a secret meeting between economic and political elites, you know the rest of the story is not going to go well for common people. And that's exactly the case in this story, because the economic elites came in and they said, look, we want to make a lot of money without a lot of risk. And the king said, oh, great, I want to make a lot of money, and I don't want to work. So what can we do for each other? And the king said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you what's called a corporate charter, your birth certificate, if you're people. I'm going to give you a corporate charter that's going to allow you to live forever, and I'm also going to sweeten the pot with a little something called limited liability. Can somebody in the audience, without making us all feel like we accidentally signed up for a law school class, tell me what limited liability is? Okay, so there's no risk beyond what you initially invest. That's a really good answer. And that means if I started a corporation and I needed money, I said, hey, Paul, can you give me $10,000? And he says, sure. And then I take the money and I incorporate and I start puttering around the Gulf of Mexico. And oh, no, my oil rig explodes, kills workers, and spills, you know, millions of barrels of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, devastates economies and ecosystems. And I say, hey, Paul, we're in a lot of trouble. Can you help me out? And Paul says, nope. I just donated $10,000. That's all I did. Good luck. So the whole form itself actually says that individual people are wrested from their responsibility for the actions, for the consequences of their actions. So it's really terrifying. And if you have a corporation that's incredibly powerful, it's even more terrifying. And that's what the king and the economic elites of Europe created when they met over the course of however many years, way, way back when. So let's stop for a second in this story and identify some core features of the modern corporation, because you might recognize them as being alive and well today. So one of them we already mentioned, which is that the corporate form incentivizes irresponsibility and is a perfect vehicle for mass imperialism and colonization. There are a couple other features I think are really important. Often we hear of corporations as free market success stories. Who's heard that before? Yeah, okay. But the reality is that the corporation cannot exist without the express legal, political, and military backing of the state. So the corporation is a creature of the state, a creature of law. And why is that important? Sounds pretty boring. I think it's important because serious social movements throughout time have recognized that power is not inevitable, it's constructed. And that's good news, because if power is constructed and you don't like it, you can deconstruct it and construct another kind of power. And that's important to me because I'm 31. I've lived 31 years under extreme corporate capitalism. And for me, it's very easy to say, well, that's just how it is. People get paid nothing at their jobs. We enslave masses of the population. You know, food comes from the grocery store. It's usually poisoned. I breathe bad air. That's just how it is. But it isn't how it is. It was how it was created by people who had very deliberate strategies and motives for creating that. So that will be important as we come back later and talk about what we as people can do about this problem. The third thing that I think is really important in this story is that oppression, or tyranny, as our friends in the revolutionary period often referred to it as, is always political and economic. It's a deal between political and economic elites. And if you want to create bad power, power over other people, you better have your political and your economic sides of that power down. And if you want to resist bad power and create good power, people power, you need to have a movement that recognizes both economic and political tyranny or oppression. And the corporation is essentially one of the best metaphors, or one of the most terrifying realities that we have, of concentrated economic and political tyranny in one form. Right? Okay, so there we are. That's the birth of the modern corporation, and we're going to jump forward 250 years to talk about democracy. But before we do, I want to say one more thing, which is that throughout this story that I'm going to tell, there's a theme. And the theme is people in power organize to exploit and harm other people for profit, and people who are being exploited and harmed organize to resist. And that's the theme of history. That's one theme of history. And I'm on the latter side. I don't know about you all, or I think I know about you all. And so this story will be about both corporate power and democracy the whole time. So let's jump forward 250 years and come to a place called the 13 colonies across the Atlantic in what would become the United States of America. And I want to ask you another trivia question, which is, can somebody tell me what the most powerful corporation was at the time that the American Revolution was heating up? The British East India Company. You guys are real smart. Waman's been doing their job. That's awesome. The British East India Company. The British East India Company is so powerful. I mean, just think of the most powerful transnational corporation you can today. Walmart, fill in the blank. The British East India Company made that corporation look like a toddler in diapers. The British East India Company was so powerful that it controlled whole swaths of the globe in corporate fiefdoms. It had its own fleet of ships that rivaled the British Navy. It had its own court system, because why should rich people have to abide by the same laws as us? And to sweeten the pot, the majority of the members of British Parliament owned stock in the British East India Company. So why is that important? You came to talk about Citizens United. Why am I telling you about a bunch of ships? It's important because the British East India Company was related to the British Parliament through these financial dealings. And that makes the story of the American Revolution make a lot more sense. Because when I was growing up in high school, my teacher, and I think a lot of teachers will accept, is Alan your name? Okay, you probably don't tell this story, which is great. But my teacher told me this story. They told me that the American Revolution was about two things. One was that people really didn't like one particular guy who liked to sit on gold thrones and order people around. Who was that? King George III. So they wanted to get rid of King George III and monarchs in general. And my teacher also told me that a lot of the people in the American Revolution were very angry about taxation without what? Representation. Representation. The fact that we can all say that answer means that someone really wanted us to know that and think that that was the reason for the American Revolution. And those were two reasons that people fought the American Revolution. But guess what? Just like now, back then, not everybody agreed. And there were a lot of people who fought the American Revolution for a lot of different reasons. And to understand some reasons that we don't often hear, we're going to have to figure out this connection between the British East India Company and Parliament. So the British East India Company was just one of many corporations who were cruising around the 13 original colonies making a lot of money. Let's talk about that. Often I say the phrase 13 original colonies so many times. I did growing up that I was like, oh yeah, 13 original colonies, blah, 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 blah. What's a colony? So you said independent. I would argue that it's actually a dependent group. And so what is it dependent on? Who?
It's usually
chartered. Okay. By the king? Okay, that's very important. So why do empires want colonies? Boss them around? What? Extract resources. Okay, colonies are very valuable for empires because they are a source of raw materials, resources, and labor for the empire. And so the 13 original colonies, my teacher told me that they were about freedom of religion and freedom of political expression. Some people came there for that reason, but mostly what they were about were profit-making enterprises. 12 of the original 13 colonies at some point were actually corporate charters. That means, like you said, that they were chartered by the king and given to rich men to control as if they were a corporation to make money. So the colony was a corporation and the governor was essentially a CEO. So if you're a CEO of a corporation or a colony and you want to make a lot of money, who do you have to bring over to the United States or the 13 colonies to do your work for you? Because I don't know if you all have heard, but rich people don't like doing their own work. It's just a thing. So they have to bring people over, right? So who do they bring over?
Slaves.
So slaves.
Indentured
servants.
Political
prisoners. Orphans. Is that who said orphans? Great. So not great. I mean, terrible, but right. Debtors. Okay. So debtors, orphans, for the crime of vagrancy, which is essentially, as far as I can tell, being poor in public. So they brought these people over to do the work of the corporate taskmasters of the American colonies. And so these people who were brought over and enslaved or indentured had to know something about power and how it worked. What do they know? They knew that power is political and economic because they looked at the CEO and they realized he was the same guy as the governor. And they realized he was making a lot of money off of their backs and that the things that made him a lot of money were incorporated into law by legislatures that invested in him. So they saw this connection. Does that sound familiar to people? Happening now, right? Okay, so when the American Revolution starts heating up and there are a bunch of rich merchants in Boston saying, we need to get represented when we're taxed and we need to get rid of the king, a lot of people in the poorer parts of the colonies had a good belly laugh and they're like, you think that's going to solve your problem? We have a bigger idea. And a lot of those people had a lot of bigger ideas. Can some people tell me what some of the demands of American revolutionaries were beyond the end of taxation without representation and the end to monarchy? Okay, full enfranchisement, regardless of how much land you own or how important you are. Anybody else? Freedom. Okay, so that's a big one. Freedom, equality, justice. Yeah. Right, so they wanted protection from quartering troops and from supporting the military at the expense of their own liberties.
They wanted to speak their mind.
Yes, they wanted to be heard, and many of them didn't just wait to be heard. They formed what we call a democracy out of doors. It's a very quaint British way of saying people gathering in the streets to engage in town halls or in public meetings that were participatory in nature and that were very profound to make decisions that affected their lives. There were lots of other things, yeah. Exactly, freedom of the press. There were a lot of other demands. I'll just list a few. People basically democratized the military so that they had an incredible amount of say in the military. They would stop foreclosures of their friends' lands when rich people came to foreclose on them. So they had a demand to end foreclosures of small farmers' lands. There were enslaved Africans who escaped slavery and started free colonies. There were people who were fighting for paper currency, the elimination of debt, and equal distribution of wealth and land to every person. And of course, there were indigenous people who were already here who were saying, hey, this is actually our land, so give it back. So there was that too. Incredible demands that are pretty big and that go way beyond just deposing a king. And this tension was there, once again, between wealth and wealthy people in the United States or the 13 colonies and the regular people who fought in the revolution as well, and then also the fight against tyranny in Britain. And so that helps us to understand a lot about things like the Boston Tea Party, which I heard a lot about in school as well. I guess if you don't like a king, you just throw a bunch of his tea in the harbor and he cries and then you got a revolution. Why? Why, if you don't like the king, are you going to throw a bunch of tea in the harbor? That doesn't make a lot of sense unless we recognize that the colonists explicitly connected the taxes on tea and other commodities as being a mechanism of colonization that was brought to them by a union of the political and the economic elite. So they recognized that. These taxes weren't so onerous that they were saying, I couldn't possibly go on. Not one more tax on tea. They were saying, I could pay this tax, but I refuse because I see it as an example of the union between economic and political interests and the takeover of my everyday life and my ability to have liberty. And so the American Revolution was always explicitly both anti-monarchical and anti-corporate. It was against concentrated political tyranny in the form of the king and concentrated economic tyranny in the form of the corporation. And so we fought a war, and particularly poor people fought the war. And when the war was over and the dust settled and the common enemy was gone, people looked around and they said, maybe I, a poor yeoman farmer in Massachusetts, don't actually have a lot in common with this wealthy merchant in Boston. And so these schisms started to form. And the wealthy merchants got together, and they approached the Articles of Confederation Congress, and they said, hey, do you think that we could maybe get together and have a meeting about whether the trade needs of the... whether, you know, the trade needs of the country are being met by the trade laws and the Articles of Confederation. And the Congress said something to the effect of, yeah, sounds super boring, knock yourselves out. And so they went and they gathered in a little town called Philadelphia, and they closed the door and they talked for a long time, and instead of writing up some trade suggestions, they wrote something else. What did they write? The Constitution of the United States. And when they got together to write that Constitution, they made some speeches at the beginning, and you can read them, they're archives. And they basically said, we're here today because we're really terrified about one phenomenon that's happening around us, one thing. We want to quash one thing in particular. Does anybody know what that thing was? Anarchy? Another word for that they used? Yeah.
Democracy.
Democracy.